Morning, Council. The next case is A24-0753, John Lee Littlejohn, petitioner appellant versus State of Minnesota respondent. Council, while you're setting up, I'll say what I'm sure you already know. This case is being, argument is being live streamed, but we keep only an audio version on our public website for later posting. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. If each of you would please state your name and a party you represent at the start of your principal arguments, we'd appreciate that. And the podium goes up and down as you need it. And counsel for appellant, we're ready for you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, John Littlejohn. This court must reverse Mr. Littlejohn's conviction because his attorney inappropriately conceded his guilt of the top count. I want to make one thing clear to start, and that is that we are not challenging the district court's or post-conviction court's credibility determinations. In fact, our first argument to the post-conviction court after that hearing, this is at document 79, pages 2-3, was that even if the court believed everything Ms. Reverine, the lawyer, testified to, Mr. Littlejohn was still entitled to relief. And that remains our position today. There are two facts found by the post-conviction court that are critically important and resolve this case. The first fact is that Ms. Reverine conceded Mr. Littlejohn's guilt of second-degree criminal sexual conduct, not just fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, which of course hadn't even been charged, and not just generally. She conceded his guilt of the top count when she said that the child is credible, and that is undisputed. The state agrees with that. That's at footnote 3 of their brief. Ms. Reverine agreed with that. She testified to that at page 17 of the transcript. And this court, in its previous opinion at star 2 in the unpublished version, also agreed with that. She conceded his guilt of the top count, not the bottom, not a bottom count. So the second fact that's critically important. I'm sorry, Your Honor, did you have a question?
Well, it seems like this case comes down to, I might be wrong, that the appellant conceded or consented to his lawyer conceding that the child's testimony was credible, but didn't concede, your argument is, to guilt under the second degree criminal sexual conduct, perhaps because there's a disconnect in his understanding of what conceding to her count being credible means in terms of conceding to the guilt. So where does that fit in analytically? Sure. It seems like is it an uninformed consent? How does this all figure in the analysis?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and I think you've probably got it about right, because the post-conviction court found that those were the words that Mr. Littlejohn told his lawyer to use. His lawyer never told him that those words meant that he was conceding guilt of the top count. They do, in fact, mean that. And so I think you can look to the Luby decision for some guidance here as to the disconnect that you referenced. Because in Luby, the bottom line is the Supreme Court and this court looks to what is the effect of the lawyer's statement? Is it a concession of guilt? Because if it is, and the client didn't concede to the concession, it doesn't matter that the client might have agreed to the words the lawyer was going to use. Because that's why we have lawyers. We have lawyers to tell lay clients, these are words, and here's the legal effect of the words that you want me to use. So in Luby, the defense lawyer said that he was conceding premeditation. And he said the real issue in this case is intent. It's a first-degree murder case, right? And he said the real issue is intent. And then he proceeded to argue why the state hadn't proven intent. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said not only had he conceded premeditation, but he had also conceded intent, even though he kind of didn't mean to. Because by conceding premeditation, you've sort of de facto automatically conceded intent. You can't have premeditation without intent. And it didn't matter that the lawyer actually affirmatively argued that the state hadn't proven intent. That didn't matter to the Supreme Court. What they held was that once you concede it, we're done. You've conceded the guilt. You've conceded that, in that case, that element. Well, here, Ms. Reverine agreed that she conceded second-degree criminal sexual conduct when she said the child is credible. Mr. Littlejohn, it is undisputed, I think, did not want her to concede second-degree criminal sexual conduct. The post-conviction court found that at page 6 of its order. At page 7 of its order, the post-conviction court found that Mr. Littlejohn wanted her, quote, to concede his guilt to the hypothetical fifth-degree offense, and found that the defendant was, quote, fixated on the idea of being found guilty only, that's the post-conviction court's words, not mine, only of a fifth-degree offense. That's not what Ms. Reverine conceded. She conceded he was guilty of the second-degree offense, and he didn't want that, and he didn't tell her to do that, and that made absolutely no sense. None of anything Ms. Reverine did in this case made any sense. Mr. Littlejohn,
why isn't this issue absolved by the district court's findings that Ms. Reverine informed him that, I'm trying to remember what the precise words were, but that this would that this could potentially mean he was guilty of second degree, as opposed to saying would? Because I think you can appreciate that oftentimes, defense counsel are put in positions where they have challenging clients, and they, use hedging language because, that's part of dealing with navigating those relationships.
I think, Your Honor, the specific context here really matters. So yes, lawyers love to hedge. Everybody loves to hedge. But the difference, we're talking about a concession of guilt here. We're not talking about what may happen if you testify or you don't testify, what a jury might think if you say this versus we call this witness or that witness. When we're talking about conceding guilt of the top count, the lawyer has to tell the client that is what will happen. And even if she can't say, I guarantee you the judge will find you guilty, I mean, I guess there's nullification, there's all kinds of, a meteor could hit the courthouse, anything could happen. What she has to tell him is that if I say these words, we are conceding that you are in fact guilty. You have no defense to second degree criminal sexual conduct. Now, knowing that, do you want me to say these words? And if that had happened and Mr. Littlejohn said, yes, I want you to say those words, knowing that you are conceding that I'm guilty of the top count, then maybe we have a different case here. But obviously, that did not happen. Ms. Reverine's comment about, I told him that if I made this concession, the judge could do all kinds of things, could find him guilty. Well, of course the judge could find him guilty. Judge could always find him guilty. There's evidence that he's guilty. That's not the question. The question is, what are you conceding? And if Ms. Reverine wanted to concede something, she had to be very clear with her client about what she was conceding. And whether she knew it, maybe she didn't know that she was conceding second-degree criminal sexual conduct. I hope she didn't know that, but it doesn't matter. What matters is she did concede it. There was no strategic value to conceding really anything in this case. Because, of course, fifth degree was not even charged. So this is not a case like a lot of the murder cases you'll see where people, lawyers will concede manslaughter in order to convince the jury to acquit on murder. That can be a very reasonable strategy. There's no manslaughter here. There's no lesser count.
But isn't that partially because this is a stipulated evidence trial and normally wouldn't, as I understand, I think one of the complexities of this case is the manner in which this case is coming to us, because often these come in the context of jury trials, and I have maybe found one case where there was even a written closing argument upon which the case was based. And so isn't part of the problem that if this had gone to trial, it would have been the defense who would have said, we want a jury instruction on a lesser-included offense, even if the state hadn't charged the lesser-included offense? I mean, I feel like there's a weird nuance with this case with regard to whether in the context of a stipulated evidence trial can defense counsel ask for a lesser included the way that they would ask for that kind of instruction in front of a jury?
I think absolutely, Your Honor. The stipulated evidence trial only cabins the type of evidence that's submitted to the district court and the form in which that evidence is submitted. And in fact, the district court judge, the original judge, Judge Cutter, was really clear with Mr. Littlejohn about this. At the original trial hearing, she says to him several times, "You're not agreeing this happened. You're not agreeing that the facts here are true. I'm going to decide who's credible." It's just a trial like any other trial. And when Judge Cutter found Mr. Littlejohn guilty, in her footnote addressing the concession, she said, well, the defense never asked for a lesser included offense. She didn't say the defense is precluded from asking for a lesser included offense, because they're not. That could have been absolutely something that's done at a trial. And in fact, sometimes where stipulated evidence trials are used to sort of move a case along, that happens. Because the parties might anticipate that, and a defendant might say, "Well, I'll take my chances, knowing that there's a lesser offense out there. I'll waive my trial rights, and I won't insist on cross-examining anybody." That didn't happen here. And Ms. Revering agreed that she didn't submit, ask for a lesser included. The judge, Judge Cutter, found that she didn't ask for a lesser included. So fifth degree is never on the table, and yet here we are talking about fifth degree. I did want to ask, you know, Your Honor, at page 10. Footnote 3 of our brief, there are two decisions cited from this court involving concessions of guilt in stipulated evidence trials. One is from 2024, one is from 2009, both of which involve this court reversing the conviction for an improper concession.
So back to my initial question around framing.
Yes.
in this case. So as you talk about, like, the person could concede facts that they did something,
yep,
and then the lawyer understands that means an element is proof. So sure, oh, I for sure meant to kill him. You know, the lawyer knows that satisfies the intent element. But if the person says, "I concede," tells the lawyer, "I consent to you conceding that I meant to kill him," you know, that's what is within their mind frame to understand, perhaps, as a defendant, what they conceding, what they did, as opposed to the sort of the legal element. So is the problem here, here it's like, yeah, I consent that the child is credible, that what she said is credible, believable. Is the problem less about the consent, given that's what, like, the defendant would be thinking of consenting to sort of factually, versus failing to, as you said, explain properly that means conceding to guilt of the top, of the second, sorry, not top, the only, the second degree charge? Where is it, a lack of consent, or is it bad advising?
It's both, Your Honor. I think they're kind of two sides of the same coin. What we look for in a consent, in a concession, I keep saying consent, concession case, is did the defendant agree to his lawyer conceding his guilt? The lawyer of the charge at issue. And I think that's actually really important in this case, because not conceding guilt generally, not conceding a fact, but conceding guilt of the charge that the lawyer concedes guilt on. If this case had been charged with CSC 2, count 1, CSC 5, count 2, and the lawyer came in and said, "We concede it was a CSC 5, but we dispute that it was a CSC 2. That would be a much more ordinary concession case. And we have cases that are sort of like that. That would still be odd here because there's not much difference between the two counts, but whatever. At least that would be a little bit more understandable. The lawyer here conceded guilt of CSC 2 when all her client wanted her to do, according to the post-conviction court, was concede guilt of CSC 5. And that's no good. an instruction to concede guilt of a lesser count, which again doesn't exist here, does not allow the lawyer to concede guilt of the top count. And that seems pretty basic, that the whole point of this is that the client says, I might be willing to take responsibility for X, but not for Y. And Mr. Littlejohn was very clear about that. He turned down an offer to plead guilty to second degree criminal sexual conduct. Ms. Revering's offer on his behalf was to plead guilty to fifth degree criminal sexual conduct, which the state turned down, which is fine. So then we have a trial. But the only count submitted at the trial is the count Mr. Littlejohn had said he wouldn't plead guilty to. And so if Mr. Littlejohn had told his lawyer, if the lawyer had testified, he was like, "Forget it, I'm guilty. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm guilty. She could have arranged for him to come in and plead guilty. If Mr. Littlejohn had said, I want you to say the child is credible, and the lawyer had said to him, you understand that that means you're conceding that you're guilty of the top count, the second degree count. That's what the judge is going to find you guilty of. That's what you say you're guilty of. That would be a different case. But none of those things happened. In the light most favorable to the state, what the post-conviction court found was that Mr. Littlejohn wanted his lawyer to say he was guilty of the fifth degree count, but she went one step further than that.
May I ask a question? It might go
sure.
Beyond. So the way I understand the post-conviction court's order, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the district court decided that this was an express consent case and didn't actually analyze any of the acquiescence factors under Luby. Do you think the record is sufficient for us to decide the acquiescence question, or would we need to remand to the post-conviction court to evaluate acquiescence if we agree with you that this isn't an express consent case?
Yeah. I do think the record is sufficient, Your Honor, for you to address them, because the facts are the facts. The post-conviction court found all the essential facts here, and the question of acquiescence is a legal question. Our brief cites a Minnesota Supreme Court case. It's one of the Pertines, I think, for the proposition that the reasonableness of the strategy is a de novo decision. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. Can I finish the answer?
Mm-hmm.
The Minnesota Supreme Court in Luby itself, there was no post-conviction hearing in Luby at all. The concession claim there was raised for the first time on direct appeal. And the Minnesota Supreme Court went through the factors about consent or acquiescence on its own and said, not good enough, we're reversing. So no, there's no requirement for a remand. There are no facts to be developed. Everything is a legal question before Your Honors at this point.
Thank you. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Rob Riant, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in today's matter. Now, appellant wanted to make two concessions in closing arguments. He wanted to concede the child victim was credible, and that meant that he conceded that her allegations that he engaged in conduct that constituted second-degree CSC were credible. And he wanted to concede and ask the court to sua sponte find him guilty of an uncharged lesser-degree offense of fifth-degree CSC. In the words of his attorney, quote unquote, that's not on the table, that's not how this works. She advised him that what he wanted to do is not something that she would advise him to do. And in fact, she further advised him that if they engaged in either of those concessions, if they made either of those concessions in closing arguments, that he would be found guilty of the charged second degree offense. That was her testimony.
He could be. Does that matter?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't.
Why not?
I will draw the court's attention to the specific language that Ms. Revering used because there were some questions about that from Judge Larson and from Judge Smith. So on pages 35 to 36 of the transcript, she says, like I told Mr. Littlejohn in the back, if you say you're guilty of anything, this judge can look at this and say you're guilty of second degree. She was specifically advising him that if he conceded any guilt, that that's going to result in a second degree charge. On page 47, when she was asked during her direct examination, I believe, when Mr. Littlejohn called you and told you to ask the judge to find him guilty of fifth degree CSC, did you tell him that if that happened, he would have to register? No. At that point, I told him if he concedes to any guilt, the judge could find him guilty of the second degree. I don't think the could versus the will makes any distinction here. And to the extent that a different presiding judge could think that there was a distinction, then we have to still consult what the district court made in its findings of fact based on its credibility determinations. Because the post-conviction court, hearing her testimony, then made the subsequent finding of fact that Littlejohn granted his attorney authority to concede his guilt. That was a finding of fact. That, quote, Revering effectively counseled Littlejohn and conceded his guilt only after he insisted she do so. Concede his guilt. She advised him that if he conceded any guilt to any degree, fifth or second, that he's going to get one outcome. and that's a guilty verdict to second-degree CSC. And the state's position on appeal to
that
be very...
It just seems less directly conveyed to the client as opposed to what you're saying, because he didn't want to be found guilty of second-degree criminal sexual conduct.
He wanted something the law couldn't give him. He wanted...
Right.
And that's... I think we're all in agreement here. But... And had she made those concessions without having those communications and those advice to him, then we'd be in a very different spot. But the record that we have here, again, under the credibility determinations of the post-conviction court, is that Ms. Revering advised her client against doing that. And that was consistent throughout her entire representation. On November 3rd, she told him fifth degree is not on the table. That's at page 44 of the transcript. On November 3rd, he started asking about fifth degree, and she said no, because that's not what you're charged with. On November 4th, at pages 35 of the transcript, you're not charged with the fifth degree, and we're not going to talk about this. She consistently was telling him, even though he was asking for a fifth degree charge, either to be, you know, charged out or to plead guilty or what have you, she was telling him, no, you cannot simply plead guilty to fifth degree, period.
Right. She's correcting his misimpression that somehow he will get convicted of,
correct,
of that charge. But did it correct, did it explain to him, given that he kept, well, not even given that, did it, is there an explanation that if you concede to the victim's credibility of her account, that is a concession to second-degree criminal sexual conduct?
Yes, that's her advice on November 3rd at pages 35 to 36 of the transcript, where she said, if you say you're guilty of anything, which would be conceding the credibility of the child victim, the judge can look at this and say you're guilty of second-degree. And I just want to clarify why that has so much meaning here, because we have to consider what the two charges are in question, fifth-degree CSC and second-degree CSC. It's important to note the only difference between those two is the age of the victim and then the disparity in the age between the abuser and the victim. And it's not really challenged at all on the record about the birth dates of the victim and her grandfather, the sexual abuser here. She was younger than 13, and he was older than her by more than 36 months. So what that means is if he concedes to fifth-degree CSC that I engaged in sexual contact with sexual intent, and then couple that together with the other unambiguous factors about her age and his age, that de facto constitutes second-degree CSC. And she knew that, and she was advising him of that. That's what she was telling him, and that's what the record shows, and that's what the post-conviction court found her advice to be.
How do we reconcile that with the post-conviction court's explicit findings that he did not wish to be convicted of second-degree criminal sexual conduct? Because I do think that, as Judge Smith pointed out during appellant's argument, that what is in tension here is this very express desire to not be convicted of second-degree criminal sexual conduct. And I think our decision that we made in his direct appeal, that by conceding credibility, that is precisely what happened. And I think we're bound by that decision. And so how do we reconcile the explicit finding of the post-conviction court that that was not what he expressed that he wanted his lawyer to do?
So his desired goals were legally inconsistent. The law could not afford him what he wanted. Regardless of whether he wanted, or I should say, regardless of whatever he thought or felt, that's what the law was. And again, that's why it's so critical that Ms. Revering testified that she gave him advice that what he was asking for is, quote unquote, that's not how this works, that's not on the table. She was telling her client that what he wanted is not something that the law could afford him. But he, in his own autonomy, in control of his case, said, I don't care, I'm the client, I'm instructing you to make these concessions. The two concessions that she had already previously advised him would result in a verdict of guilty to the second degree.
What are the two again? When you say two concessions, I know you said at the start of it, but what are they?
And I apologize. The two concessions he wanted her to make was to concede the victim's credibility and then to ask the court to find him guilty of fifth degree CSC.
Oh,
I characterize that as a concession to guilt to fifth degree CSC.
Okay. Thanks.
Now, it was previously asked about whether this is an express consent case, and the state's position is that it is. And so looking at the framework of the analysis set forth in State v. Luby, the 2017 decision, the first question is whether did the attorney concede his or her client's guilt? And that is a law of the case question, as Your Honor, Judge Larson mentioned. On appeal, on direct appeal, on the second page of the non-presidential decision, the state conceded that she did, in fact, concede his guilt to second-degree CSC. And so the question then, the second question is, does the record show evidence of express consent? And I want to be clear that the state's position is that is a factual inquiry. I would cite the Humble v. State decision from 2000 that stands for the proposition that express consent is a factual determination, and there's no need to then proceed to see if acquiescence, because at that point in time, it's a foregone conclusion. If there's evidence of express consent in the record, that's where the inquiry ends, and that's where the verdict is upheld. I would further point the court's attention to the Pertien decision from 2011. I think it's said as Pertien 2 in Appellant's brief. There, the court noted that the finding from the lower court that the defendant, quote-unquote, heard and understood the concession was a finding of historical fact. So when you are dealing with factual questions about was the defendant present, did the defendant understand, did the defendant know what they were doing, was in fact a concession, those are factual questions. And the reason why that does so much heavy lifting in this case is because the record that we have here is that he says time and time again, I don't want to be found guilty of second-degree CSC. And he can say that, but the fact of the matter is that his attorney advised him that making those two concessions to the credibility of the child victim and to the fifth-degree CSC de facto will result in a charge.
Then why isn't this an acquiescence case? I mean, I guess I'm a bit troubled by the fact that I think that the panel on direct appeal signaled that their view that this was an acquiescence case, and yet we have an order returned to us that doesn't actually analyze acquiescence. When there is sort of this fuzzy area around whether he actually understood that he was pleading guilty to CSC2 by conceding credibility. And so I guess my question is, why isn't this an acquiescence case? Why don't we have to get into the acquiescence case law as opposed to the express consent case law?
I would say, if I could respond to that, with three kind of steps to show why this is an express consent case. First of all, I drew the court's attention already to her testimony about that she advised him that pleading guilty to anything less or pleading any guilt will result in a guilty verdict for the second degree. That's the first step. Second,
so I just want to make sure I understand your argument on that. So your argument is that the waiving the credibility issue doesn't really matter because he conceded to fifth degree. By conceding to fifth degree, it was the same thing as conceding to the credibility of the victim, and therefore even if they had said nothing about the credibility of the victim, he had conceded to second degree by conceding fifth. I just want to make sure that I understand your argument.
The record shows that the defendant, Mr. Littlejohn, knew, based on the advice of his counsel, that if he entered or pled guilty to any version of this, that would be de facto pleading guilty to second degree CSC. That was the legal advice he heard, received, and that he had actual knowledge about. That's what the record shows based on the factual findings, credibility of the court. And then, in light of that, even having received that advice, as she testified, you had his permission to write the closing as you wrote it here. That's on page 51 of the transcript. Or to put it in appellant's own terms on page 20 of their brief, he knew the words that she was going to use in the closing argument. So this is not, he was surprised by the words that were contained in the closing argument. It's not like the State v. Luby decision where the defendant didn't anticipate that his attorney was going to concede the premeditation element. He instructed his attorney to use the specific words that were in the closing argument, the two specific concessions. So that's why it's an express consent. And then on page 12 of the transcript, okay, specifically, you conceded, Ms. Revering, that the child was credible, right? Yes. Did Mr. Littlejohn instruct you to concede that he was guilty? Yes. That's it. That's a direct consent. That's him instructing his attorney to make those concessions after having received accurate legal advice that making those concessions would result in second-degree CSC. There is an inference there, but the fact is that he received that legal advice, and he knew what he was getting himself into by moving forward with those concessions.
Thanks. That answered my question. I think you were moving on to step two. You had your three-step analysis, and I interrupted you in the middle here.
I think I answered the question. Is the idea is that if you couple together the advice that he received and the fact that he still nevertheless instructed her to make those concessions after receiving that advice, that's the link that shows why this is an express consent case, not an acquiescence case. Okay. The state's position is that the question before the court is a factual one, and that under the clear error standard, the district court's, the post-conviction court's findings of fact and credibility determinations are supported by the record. And so the state is asking this court to affirm the post-conviction court's order. And unless the court has any questions.
So I'll just ask one question, counsel. Appellant's counsel has been really clear that they are not second-guessing the district court's credibility determinations. Specifically, I think of Mr. Littlejohn. So does that impact our analysis of the case on appeal? I mean, I didn't hear you reference it in your argument right now.
No, and that's a good question, because appellant does maintain that they're not challenging the credibility and the fact-finding, but that's in effect what they're doing. To put it another way, in order to find for appellant, in order to reverse, this court would have to find the district court conclusion that Littlejohn granted his attorney authority to concede his guilt, contained on page 8 of the addendum, is wrong. That's a factual finding that the district court made. This court would have to overturn that factual finding to grant appellant relief. In order to grant appellant relief, this court would have to overturn the district court's findings on page 6-7 of the addendum, where it held that Revering effectively counseled Littlejohn and conceded his guilt only after he insisted she do so. Again, these are findings of fact that are buttressed by the post-conviction court's credibility determinations. That's why the only way that appellant can seek relief in this case is to challenge and overturn those factual findings.
I guess the way I understand appellant's argument is that there are findings within this order that are internally inconsistent, that it is inconsistent for the district court in one part of the order to find that he did not want to be convicted of second degree, and that that is internally inconsistent with saying he directly consented to pleading guilty to second to his guilt on second degree, and that those two are internally inconsistent, and that that's where the clear error comes in. It's not, I just want to make sure that you have an opportunity to respond to that. It's not that the district court's findings aren't supported in the record, it's that there are findings within this order that conflict with one another. And I wonder if you could respond to that.
Yes, argument. Your Honor. So there's nothing inconsistent with that, because what the district court found is that Littlejohn didn't want to be convicted of second-degree CSC. That is entirely consistent with what he did. No one wants to be guilty of CSC. I mean, his desire to avoid that charge, that's his desire, that's his prerogative. The fact of the matter is that his attorney said, if we move forward with your course of action, you're going to get a guilty verdict on second-degree CSC.
Well, you might.
Well, you could, and she said that, and in fact, she advised that the path that you're trying to take is not something that the law affords and not something that it contemplates. So basically, you're asking me to engage in an endeavor that will result in second-degree CSC because it can't result in anything else. The court can't give you a fifth-degree CSC verdict just sua sponte. That's quite clear in the record. And so with that knowledge that he had from his legal advice, he then instructed her to make the concessions. That's why there's nothing inconsistent without his stated desire that he wants to avoid second-degree CSC, but then advising his attorney to move forward or instructing his attorney to move forward with those concessions. And my time is out, but there's just one coda to that that I do want to, you know, that's mentioned in briefing, is remember his stated goal was to have a relationship with his family after this. That's also clear in the record. So in his head, he might be thinking, I don't want a second degree verdict. I also want to have a maintain a relationship with my family. So I'll concede her guilt, and let's see, maybe something happens, right? Like nullification, like opposing counsel mentioned. Now, that's not something that was afforded to him. He knew that, or he was advised that's not something that's afforded to him. But that's nonetheless a rational, understandable position where he says, I want to have a family. I want to do everything in my power to avoid the higher charge, even if he's received advice that that's not something that would happen.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant.
Thank you. I wanted to address some of Judge Larson's questions and be really clear about the post-conviction court's order, which I'm sure you've all read. You'll read it again. It's only 8 pages long. The post-conviction court did not find that Mr. Littlejohn knew that by saying the child is credible, he was conceding second-degree criminal sexual conduct. I heard some lines from opposing counsel sort of implying that that was a finding that was made by the post-conviction court. It is not there. To the contrary, the post-conviction court found at page 7, quote, Little John insisted that she, meaning her Reverend, should concede his guilt to the hypothetical fifth-degree offense, end quote. And so every time you think about when my able opponent says conceded guilt, concede his guilt, it would be helpful if you would then say, of what? Because nowhere in this record does either Mr. Littlejohn or, for that matter, Ms. Reverine say that Mr. Littlejohn wanted her to concede guilt of second-degree criminal sexual conduct. That does not exist here. And that is the gravamen of the state's argument. And this difference between would and could that's been referenced a couple of times by Judge Smith and Judge Larson and counsel, I'll just remind the court that we have an entire body of Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance case law on immigration that hinges on the difference between would and could. If the immigration consequences of a guilty plea are clear, counsel has to tell the client what those consequences are. You will be deported. If the immigration consequences are not super clear, you could be deported, counsel's obligation is a lot less. Would and could matters. And what the district court found was that, and what Ms. Reverine testified to is, sure, you might be found guilty of second degree if I say this, because of course you could do a closing argument that says he's not guilty of anything. This child is not credible. You should find that the state hasn't proven its case. That would be the most, you know, aggressive defense closing argument. And Ms. Reverine was correct to say, once you don't do that, look, your chances of being found guilty of something are going to go up.
Although in context, in fairness, and I'm only drawing to context from what's said today, I don't have the transcript, is that you could be found or you can be convicted of, whichever can or could, was in the context of if you concede fifth. You know,
it was in the context of, actually, it was in the context of saying, if you say the child is credible, I think.
Okay.
And that's true. You could be. But that's not the same as telling him you are conceding that you are guilty. Saying the fact finder might find you guilty is different than telling a client, you are a criminal defense client who has repeatedly, remember, Mr. Littlejohn had repeatedly told his lawyer that he did not want to be found guilty of the second degree offense, that he did not think, not just that he didn't want to, because of course nobody wants to be found guilty of a crime, but that he didn't think he was guilty. He thought he was innocent of that charge.
Counsel, just to make sure, I think I understand your argument, but on the top of page 7 of the district court's decision, district court post-conviction found that Revering warned Littlejohn that if he conceded to any guilt, the judge could, and I appreciate you've got a whole argument about could versus word, but just set that aside, but could find him guilty of the second degree. So yes. I appreciate you're also drawing a distinction between what Littlejohn consented to. So did he expressly consent to being found guilty of CSC 2? It seems to me what the line the district court's focused on is whether he was warned of the consequences of conceding his guilt to CSC 5. Isn't that enough, counsel, to find effective assistance of counsel?
Yeah. No.
Or at least to find that it is not ineffective assistance.
Sure. The short answer is no, it's not enough. The cases, and this goes to some of Judge Larson's questions too, about consenting, expressly consenting to a concession and acquiescing to a concession.
In your view, we have to get to acquiescence.
Yes, okay. Because Mr. Littlejohn did not expressly consent to be found guilty of second degree criminal sexual conduct. I don't think the district court, post-conviction court said he did. This idea that he was sort of warned could conceivably relate to acquiescence, but then you have to go through all of the acquiescence factors. Those are legal factors that this court is perfectly capable of doing. And when you do them, you'll see that counsel's strategy here makes absolutely no sense. None. Because there is no lesser count. And she knew that. And so conceding guilt of a count that doesn't exist and conceding guilt of a top count, you can't possibly acquiesce to a strategy that makes absolutely no sense.
May I ask one question?
Sure.
I understood, and maybe I'm not phrasing it correctly, but I understood respondent to potentially be arguing today that even if you take away the credibility finding that him, that Little John agreeing to the concession to fifth degree with the advice that conceding to anything equals conceding to second degree, that that by itself was enough in this case, and we can sort of set aside the conceding the credibility of the victim issue. Do you have a response to that argument?
Yeah, I do, Your Honor. I actually wasn't sure I heard that as the state's argument, certainly not in their brief. Their brief argument is not anything that you described. I also think, again, we're talking about there's either an express consent or there's not. And if there's not, you get to acquiescence, and then you can maybe talk about, you know, what maybe would have happened and what was reasonable and what was not reasonable. But saying that, you know, you can imply that by conceding guilt of five, he's really knows he's conceding guilt of two, A, I don't know of any support for that. B, the post-conviction court did not find that. So to the extent we need to get to what was in Mr. Littlejohn's head, what did he know? We don't have a factual finding on that point. We have, in fact, we have the opposite factual finding, that he didn't want to be found guilty of the two, that he only wanted to be found guilty of the five. And if we get to acquiescence, like I said, the primary question in the acquiescence case law is, does the lawyer's strategy make sense? That's the first thing that every acquiescence case gets to. And the answer to that in this question is an easy one, no. There's no lesser included charge. There's no fifth degree charge. It doesn't make sense. And in fact, it's frivolous and unethical to, even when your client tells you to make an argument that has no basis in fact and law. And there is no basis in fact and law for the fact finder in this case to find Mr. Littlejohn guilty of a crime the state chose not to charge him with.
Thank you.
Bo,
thanks for your briefing. Thanks for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. We'll have the decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you.